The True Confessions of Charlotte Doyle, Disc 4.
Part 2. Chapter 13. For a second time, I stood in the forecastle. The room was as dark and mean as when I'd first seen it. Now, however, I stood as a petitioner in sailor's garb. A glum Fisk was at my side. It hadn't been easy to convince him I was in earnest about becoming one of the crew. Even when he begrudged a willingness to believe in my sincerity, he warned that agreement from the rest of the men would be improbable. He insisted I lay the matter before them immediately. So it was that three men from Mr. Hollybrass's watch, Grimes, Dillingham, and Foley, were the next to hear my plea. As Fisk had foretold, they were contemplating me and my proposal with very little evidence of favor. "I do mean it," I said, finding boldness with repetition. "I want to be the replacement for Mr. Johnson."
"You're a girl,"
Dillingham spat out contemptuously.
"A pretty girl,"
Foley put in. It was not meant as a compliment.
"Takes more than canvas breeches to hide that."
"And a gentlewoman," was Grimes' addition, as though that was the final evidence of my essential uselessness. "I want to show that I stand with you," I pleaded, "that I made a mistake."
"A mistake," Foley snapped. "Two able-bodied men have died."
"Besides," Dillingham agreed, "you'll bring more trouble than good."
"You can teach me," I offered.
"God's fist," Grimes cried. "She thinks this a school."
"And the captain," Foley asked, "what'll he say?"
"He wants nothing to do with me," I replied.
"That's what he says. But you were his darling girl, Miss Doyle. We takes you in, and he'll want you back again. Where would that put us?"
So it went, round and round. While the men made objections, while I struggled to answer them, Fisk said nothing. Though I tried to keep my head up, my eyes steady, it was not easy. They looked at me as if I were some loathsome thing. At the same time, the more objections they made, the more determined I was to prove myself.
"See here, Miss Doyle," Dillingham concluded. "It's no simple matter. Understand, you sign on to the articles, so to speak, and you are on. No bolting to safe harbors at the first blow or when an ill word is flung your way. You're a hand or you're not a hand, and it won't go easy. That's all that can ever be promised."
"I know," I said.
"Hold out your hands," he demanded.
Fisk nudged me. I held them out, palms up. Foley peered over them.
"Like bloody cream," he said with disgust. "Touch mine," he insisted, and extended his.
Gingerly, I touched one of them. His skin was like rough leather.
"That's the hands you'd get, miss, like an animal. Is that what you want?"
"I don't care," I said stoutly. Finally, it was Dillingham who said,
"Are you willing to take your place in the rigging, too? Fair weather or foul?"
That made me pause. Fisk caught the hesitation.
"Answer,"
he prompted. "Yes," I said boldly. They exchanged glances. Then Foley asked,
"What do the others think?"
Fisk shook his head and sighed.
"No doubt they'll speak the same."
Suddenly Grimes said,
"Here's what I say. Let her climb to the royal yard. If she does it and comes down whole, and still is willing to serve, then I say let her sign and be bloody damned like the rest of us."
"And do whatever she's called on to do."
"No less."
With no more than grunts, the men seemed to agree among themselves. They turned toward me.
"Now what does Miss Doyle say?"
Grimes demanded. I swallowed hard, but all the same I gave yet another, "Yes." Foley came to his feet.
"All right, then. I'll go caucus the others."
Out he went. Fisk and I retreated to the galley while I waited for word. During that time, he questioned me regarding my determination.
"Miss Doyle," he pressed,
You have agreed to climb to the top of the royal yard. Do you know that's the highest sail on the mainmast? 130 feet up. You can reach it only two ways. You can shimmy up the mast itself, or you can climb the shrouds using the ratlines for your ladder. I nodded as if I fully grasped what he was saying. The truth was, I didn't even wish to listen. I just wanted to get past the test. "And, Miss Doyle," he went on, "if you slip and fall, you'll be lucky to drop into the sea and drown quickly. No mortal could pluck you out fast enough to save you. Do you understand that?" I swallowed hard, but nodded. "Yes. Because if you're not lucky, you'll crash to the deck. Fall that way, and you'll either maim or kill yourself by breaking your neck. Still certain?" "Yes," I repeated, though somewhat more softly. "I'll give you this," he said with a look that seemed a mix of admiration and contempt. "Zachariah was right. You're as steady a girl as ever I've met." Foley soon returned. "We're agreed," he announced. "Not a one stands in favor of your signing on, Miss Doyle. Not with what you are. We're all agreed to that. But if you climb as high as the royal yard and make it down whole, and if you still want to sign on, you can come as equal. You'll get no more from us, Miss Doyle, but no less either."
Fisk looked at me for my answer. "I understand," I said.
"All right, then," Foley said. "The captain's still in his cabin and not likely to come out till 5 bells. You can do it now."
"Now?" I quailed.
"Now before never."
So it was that the 4 men escorted me onto the deck. There I found that the rest of the crew had already gathered. Having fully committed myself, I was overwhelmed by my audacity. The masts had always seemed tall, of course, but never so tall as they did at that moment. When I reached the deck and looked up, my courage all but crumbled. My stomach turned. My legs grew weak. Not that it mattered. Fisk escorted me to the mast as though I were being led to die at the stake. He seemed as grim as I. To grasp fully what I'd undertaken to do, know again that the height of the mainmast towered 130 feet from the deck. This mast was, in fact, 3 great rounded lengths of wood, trees, in truth, affixed one to the end of the other. Further, it supported 4 levels of sails, each of which bore a different name. In order, bottom to top, these were called the mainyard, topsail, topgallant, and finally, royal yard. My task was to climb to the top of the royal yard and come down, in one piece. If I succeeded, I'd gain the opportunity of making the climb 50 times a day. As if reading my terrified thoughts, Fisk inquired gravely,
"How will you go, Miss Doyle? Up the mast or on the ratlines?"
Once again I looked up. I could not possibly climb the mast directly. The stays and shrouds with their ratlines would serve me better. "Ratlines," I replied softly.
"Then up you go."
I will confess it. At that moment my nerves failed. I found myself unable to move. With thudding heart, I looked frantically around. The members of the crew, arranged in a crescent, were standing like death's own jury. It was Barlow who called out,
"A blessing goes with you, Miss Doyle."
To which Ewing added,
"And this advice, Miss Doyle, keep your eyes steady on the ropes. Don't you look down or up."
For the first time, I sensed that some of them at least wanted me to succeed. The realization gave me courage. With halting steps and shallow breath, I approached the rail, only to pause when I reached it. I could hear a small inner voice crying, "Don't! Don't!" But it was also then that I heard Dillingham snicker.
"She'll not have the stomach."
I reached up, grasped the lowest deadeye, and hauled myself atop the rail. That much I had done before. Now I maneuvered to the outside so that I would be leaning into the rigging, and could even rest on it. Once again I looked at the crew. Down at them, I should say. They were staring up with blank expressions. Recollecting Ewing's advice, I shifted my eyes and focused them on the ropes before me. Then, reaching as high as I could into one of the middle shrouds and grabbing a ratline, I began to climb. The ratlines were set about 16 inches, one above the other, so that the steps I had to take were wide for me. I needed to pull as much with arms as climb with legs, but line by line I did go up, as if ascending an enormous ladder. After I had risen some 17 feet, I realized I'd made a great mistake. The rigging stood in sets, each going to a different level of the mast. I could have taken one that stretched directly to the top. Instead, I had chosen a line which went only to the first trestle tree, to the top of the lower mast. For a moment, I considered backing down and starting afresh. I stole a quick glance below. The crew's faces were turned up toward me. I understood that they would take the smallest movement down as retreat. I had to continue. And so I did. Now I was climbing inside the lank gray-white sails, ascending, as it were, into a bank of dead clouds. Beyond the sails lay the sea, slate-gray and ever-rolling. Though the water looked calm, I could feel the slow pitch and roll it caused in the ship. I realized suddenly how much harder this climb would be if the wind were blowing and we were well under way. The mere thought made the palms of my hands grow damp. Up I continued, till I reached the main yard. Here I snatched another glance at the sea, and was startled to see how much bigger it had grown. Indeed, the more I saw of it, the more there was. In contrast, the Seahawk struck me as having suddenly grown smaller. The more I saw of her, the less she was. I glanced aloft. To climb higher, I now had to edge myself out upon the trestle tree, and then once again move up the next set of ratlines as I'd done before, but at twice the height. Wrapping one arm round the mast, even up here it was too big to reach around completely, I grasped one of the stays and edged out. At the same moment, the ship dipped. The world seemed to twist and tilt down. My stomach lurched. My heart pounded. My head swam. In spite of myself, I closed my eyes. I all but slipped, saving myself only by a sudden grasp of a line before the ship yawed the opposite way. I felt sicker yet. With ever-waning strength, I clung on for dearest life. Now the full folly of what I was attempting burst upon me with grotesque reality. It had been not only stupid, but suicidal. I would never come down alive. And yet, I had to climb. This was my restitution. When the ship was steady again, I grasped the furthest rigging, first with one hand, then the other, and dragged myself higher. I was heading for the topsail, 15 feet further up. Pressing myself as close as possible into the rigging, I continued to strain upward, squeezing the rope so tightly my hands cramped. I even tried curling my toes about the ratlines. At last, I reached the topsail spar, but discovered it was impossible to rest there. The only place to pause was 3 times higher than the distance I'd just come, at the trestle tree just below the topgallant spar. By now, every muscle in my body ached. My head felt light, my heart an anvil. My hands were on fire, the soles of my feet raw. Time and again I was forced to halt, pressing my face against the rigging with eyes closed. Then, in spite of what I'd been warned not to do, I opened them and peered down. The Seahawk was like a wooden toy. The sea looked greater still. I made myself glance up. Oh, so far to go. How I forced myself to move, I am not sure, but the thought of backing down now was just as frightening. Knowing only that I could not stay still, I crept upward, ratline by ratline, taking what seemed to be forever with each rise, until I finally reached the level just below the topgallant spar. A seasoned sailor would have needed 2 minutes to reach this point. I had needed 30. Though I felt the constant roll of the ship, I had to rest there. What seemed like little movement on deck became, up high, wild swings and turns through treacherous air. I gagged, forced my stomach down, drew breath, and looked out. Though I didn't think it possible, the ocean appeared to have grown greater yet. And when I looked down, the upturned faces of the crew appeared like so many tiny bugs. There were 25 or so more feet to climb. Once again, I grasped the rigging and hauled myself up. This final climb was torture. With every upward pull, the swaying of the ship seemed to increase. Even when not moving myself, I was flying through the air in wild, wide gyrations. The horizon kept shifting, tilting, dropping. I was increasingly dizzy, nauseous, terrified, certain that with every next moment I would slip and fall to death. I paused again and again, my eyes on the rigging inches from my face, gasping and praying as I had never prayed before. My one hope was that, nearer to heaven now, I could make my desperation heard. Inch by inch I continued up, half an inch, quarter inches. But then, at last, with trembling fingers, I touched the spar of the royal yard. I had reached the top. Once there, I endeavored to rest again. But there the metronome motion of the mast was at its most extreme, the Seahawk turning, tossing, swaying as if trying to shake me off, like a dog throwing droplets of water from its back. And when I looked beyond, I saw a sea that was infinity itself, ready, eager to swallow me whole. I had to get back down. As hard as it was to climb up, it was, to my horror, harder returning. On the ascent, I could see where I was going. Edging down, I had to grope blindly with my feet. Sometimes I tried to look, but when I did, the sight of the void below was so sickening I was forced to close my eyes. Each groping step downward was a nightmare. Most times my foot found only air. Then, as if to mock my terror, a small breeze at last sprang up. Sails began to fill and snap, puffing in and out, at times smothering me. The tossing of the ship grew, if that were possible, more extreme. Down I crept, past the topgallant, where I paused briefly on the trestle tree, then down along the longest stretch, toward the main yard. It was there I fell. I was searching with my left foot for the next ratline. When I found a hold and started to put my weight upon it, my foot, slipping on the slick tar surface, shot forward. The suddenness of it made me lose my grip. I tumbled backward, but in such a way that my legs became entangled in the lines. There I hung, head downward. I screamed, tried to grab something, but I couldn't. I clutched madly at nothing, till my hand brushed against a dangling rope. I grabbed for it, missed, and grabbed again. Using all my strength, I levered myself up and, wrapping my arms into the lines, made a veritable knot of myself, mast, and rigging. Oh, how I wept, my entire body shaking and trembling as though it would break apart. When my breathing became somewhat normal, I managed to untangle first one arm, then my legs. I was free. I continued down. By the time I reached the main yard, I was numb and whimpering again, tears coursing from my eyes. I moved to the shrouds I'd climbed and edged myself past the lowest of the sails. As I emerged from under it, the crew gave out a great huzzah. Oh, how my heart swelled with exultation. Finally, when I'd reached close to the very end, Barlow stepped forward, beaming, his arms uplifted. "Jump," he called. "Jump." But now determined to do it all myself, I shook my head. Indeed, in the end, I dropped down on my own two India rubber legs and tumbled to the deck. No sooner did I land than the crew gave me another huzzah! With joyous heart, I staggered to my feet. Only then did I see Captain Jaggery push through the knot of men and come to stand before me.